Hello, everyone. Welcome to Shakya Presents Movie Night. I'm your host. My name is Rudy Obias. Joining me for this episode, he's a writer for FirstShowing.net. He's also a writer for FilmSchoolRejects.com. Jeremy Kirk, thank you so much for joining me here on Movie Night.
Thank you very much for having me, Rudy. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you, good sir?
I'm good. I'm very fine.
One reason why I wanted to bring you on this episode is that the movie that we're going to be talking about is the prequel of John Carpenter's 1982 film, The Thing. It actually has the same name, The Thing, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the name of this director. It's something very Iceland or very Icelandic or
Norwegian. Yeah, very, very Finland, very, very Norwegian, whatever. A lot of consonants that seem out of place in the man's name.
And I'm just going to be an ignorant American when it comes to that and not try to pronounce it. And this is kind of a prequel to John Carpenter's 1982 film. The reason why I wanted Jeremy Kirk on the show is, well, A, he was available, and B, I know that he actually loves John Carpenter's The Thing. It's one of your favorite movies. Jeremy, please talk about how much you enjoy this film and actually what John Carpenter brings to this remake. It's actually a remake of a 1951 film, if I'm not mistaken.
The 82 version you're asking about?
Yeah.
I absolutely love the John Carpenter version of the Thing, which is more based on the short story by John W. Campbell Jr., who goes there. I believe that was from the 30s. It's more an adaptation of that than a remake of the 51 version. But I love the way that John Carpenter's film. It's a horror film, but you can almost take the creature completely out. You can almost have the entire film and never actually see the creature, because most of the film is just based on this. It's built up on this paranoia, this isolation of these men that are trapped in this outpost in the Antarctic, and the idea that there's something among them that can look like them. And all of these men who have spent all this time with each other, they start to build this paranoia about who's who. Is this person that I've spent all this time with, are they still who they used to be anymore? Are they still that person, or have they been taken over by this creature? And he just, the way that he shoots the film, the movie just feels so isolated.
So John Carpenter really does create a good sense of isolation, that it's in the middle of Antarctica and really the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere where these people lay. And this version, the 2011 version of The Thing, is a prequel or a remake. I think both could be legitimate to the 2011 version, where the 1982 version starts off with a dog in this running in the snow and a helicopter chasing after it, shooting at it. And so what is examined in this movie is where that dog was running from. And we learn in John Carpenter's version that it was a Norwegian research facility, that there's this whole camp of people of Norwegians doing research in the middle of Antarctica, and this is where the thing came from. And so this is what this 2011 film is about. It's a prequel.
In the 82 version, they actually, a small group of the men actually go to the Norwegian camp, and they see some of the aftermath of what occurred there.
Yeah, and so we get the impression just from that 1982 version that what happens in that 1982 version generally is what happened in that Norwegian camp. You know, it's the same thing. The same thing happened. This alien or whatever comes there, wreaks havoc, and then moves on. And it, spoiler alert for the 1982 version, it's really what happens in that movie as well. So, Jeremy, what are your thoughts on the 2011 prequel, The Thing?
I thought it was an unnecessary, uninteresting update to something that we've seen already. And really, the director and the writer, Eric Heiser, it almost seemed like they had a checklist of all these things that they had to get into this movie. It almost feels like how, you know, George Lucas approached the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, I should say. Like they have this checklist of all the things that happened in the original film, and they have to show this, they have to show this, they have to show this, and it's just a series of them running through. Okay, we got that out of the way, got that out of the way, we got that out of the way, and it all just seems very disconnected to the point where John Carpenter's film was built on suspense and these quiet moments. This new version of The Thing, it's just, especially the last half of the film, it's just this creature that's running rampant over this base. And that would be fine if the creature was believable, if it was scary. And the problem that we run into here is that whereas the 1982 version was all Rob Bottin practical special effects that you could actually touch, it almost looked like the characters could actually touch the creature. And in this film, it's all CG. It's all computer-generated effects that really just took me out of the film. Every time a computer effect came on screen, I'm like, okay, that just looks fake. That doesn't look like anything was there. The characters were the actors were reacting to something that wasn't even there, and you could tell. It just rings false.
See, I don't think the CG in this movie was that bad. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that it was perfect. It was just as good as the 1982 practical effects. That would be lying. But I think it was an actual good blend of practical and CGI. But I could agree with you that the CGI in this was a little questionable at times. But
I don't even want to say that it's bad CGI. There are films that have really bad computer effects. And I don't think
the Scorpion King one of them.
Scorpion King, Mummy Returns, any of those, yeah, Lost in Space, some of the worst CG ever. I don't really think that the CG in this new version of The Thing is particularly bad, but it's obvious.
Yes.
You can tell that it's CG.
But I don't think this movie is as bad as you're saying. I mean, it's definitely not as good as John Carpenter's The Thing, and I don't think anyone, at least I wasn't expecting it to be. I think the only thing I was expecting from it was a prequel, how things happened in that Norwegian camp and how it led into John Carpenter's The Thing, and just from that standpoint, I think it succeeds. I somewhat agree that there probably is a checklist, but I think that's just the tropes of having a prequel that it has to match up to.
And I think, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't want to put words in your mouth or put ideas in your head, but I think that probably one of the reasons that I dislike this movie so much and you didn't really have that big of a problem with it was that I grew up on John Carpenter's film. I've seen it. I'm no exaggeration. I've probably seen it over 50 or 60 times.
Yeah.
So I know that film so well that, and I know the scene where they go to the Norwegian camp so well that I was just waiting for these things. I'm waiting for this to happen. I'm waiting for the guy to, well, I'm not going to get into specifics, but any time that anything popped up in this movie that was kind of reflecting of something that we see in the John Carpenter film, I'm like, okay, they took that off that checklist. Whereas I believe you just saw John Carpenter's version for the first time this week, right?
Yeah, I saw it actually the day before this version. For the first time ever. But that's a great movie. I mean, even just me watching it that one time, it's great. I can absolutely see why you would watch it 50 to 60 times in your lifetime. I mean, this is it's a great movie. It's something that you would want to watch at least once or twice a year.
And I do. Actually, that's probably one of the reasons I've seen it so many times. That was one of the things that one of my go-to things in college that I would do if I was bored on a Friday or Saturday night and there was no place to go, I would order Jimmy John's and I would just pop in the thing and watch it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent film. I mean,
it really is. And it's a movie that never gets old. It's easy to sit through 100 times.
Yeah, it's a horror film where I think non-horror fans would like, because it's just the filmmaking is just so wonderful and so top tier that it's just a good movie, period, no matter what genre it is or what kind of movies you like. Mm-hmm. You'll enjoy it. But I think this version of The Thing, wherein John Carpenter's Thing is more horror, this actually is a little bit more sci-fi. It's a little bit more analytical instead of more brute force, I guess.
I can see that, yeah. I can definitely see that. But it also... John Carpenter's film is a lot more psychological.
Yeah.
Where this one is, it's physical, physical, physical. It's I don't want to say practical because it's not practical effects, but it's all right there in your face.
Yeah.
Hardly anything is really left to the imagination, especially, I'm not going to get into spoilers, obviously, but the ambiguity of John Carpenter's film, where you really don't know who the thing was at any given time, whereas in this film it's pretty obvious. They kind of spell it out. They kind of handhold the audience.
Yeah, I think, and again, I don't think this movie is as bad as what a lot of critics would say. I don't think it's great, but I don't think it's bad. I think it's right there middle of the road. It does things successfully, but it also does things poorly. One of the things it does poorly, I think, is it shows the thing. It actually shows the thing. And when you do that, I think all that imagination and all the really scary factors of it just go out the window when you show what this creature looks like.
I've heard a couple of people say that, but do you really think that it shows the thing? Because especially as they talk about in John Carpenter's film, I think MacReady brings it up, this creature has who knows how many worlds it's been to before it came to Earth.
Yeah.
Who knows how many different things it could look like. In my mind, personally, I think the thing was the size of an atom that just got into a creature and absorbed it at some point. I really don't think they show the thing in this new one.
Hmm. But I think just having that element there where, at least in my mind, just showing this alien a little bit more so than, I guess, an atom, that kind of took me a little bit out of the movie. The positives I'll say about this movie, which makes me wonder why this hasn't happened more in movies that are produced in Hollywood, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Why isn't she in more movies? I actually really liked her in this movie, and I think that was probably one of the things I took out of it the most was, her performance and just, B, her screen presence, because when she's on screen, you just can't help but not pay attention to her.
She was fine. I don't know if she really stood out for me enough in this role. She brought a very strong performance to a very strong character. But even in my review, I really don't discuss her acting in this movie much. I really didn't think that she brought a whole lot to this. I'm sorry, I don't want to get away from Mary Elizabeth. Go ahead. What you were saying about her.
I completely disagree. I think she's just absolutely wonderful. That she has this screen presence about her that, I mean, at least for me, that I can't help but not be drawn to her. Yeah. That I want to see her in more movies. And actually, I think what this film does a little bit better than John Carpenter's Thing creates a good conflict between someone who's higher up in kind of like this this camp of researchers, like someone who's your boss, and then talking down to one of their underlings. I think that conflict is really good in this movie. It's not really played up very much, but I like that element in this, that it's a research facility and not so much an army one.
Right. Which, yeah, in the John Carpenter film, they were all kind of... I think there was kind of a hierarchy of roles in the John Carpenter film, but they all kind of got blended when the shit hit the fan they really didn't seem to care after a while. My biggest problem with the characters in this new version of The Thing, it seems like we have, you know, five or six actors that we recognize, and the director kind of depends on that recognition of these actors as an identity to the characters. Whereas in John Carpenter's film, every character, you knew their name, they had their own identity, they were a character that you recognized. Whereas in this film, most of the characters, the characteristics are they're bearded Norwegian men. most of them, I couldn't tell apart. I had no idea who was who. Oh, that guy got killed. Oh, that guy got absorbed. Fine. Who is that? I don't know who that is. Fine. Whatever.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with you to that extent, but I think that's just us being American. Where
it might be.
Where it was like, you're not an American, we're not going to give you any more characteristics than this. And I agree with you somewhat, because it did kind of seem a little blended to me, like, yeah, who was who. But the character of Lars, I actually liked his character. He doesn't have that much screen time, but when he's on screen, at least everyone in my audience really reacted well to him and what his decisions were in the movie.
He was one of the Norwegian men that kind of stood out.
But I will say he's the only one that did, and I agree with you that the rest of the Norwegian men, outside of the project leader, I guess, really did blend together. You know?
It got to the point in the movie where the film starts with three Norwegian men in the snowcat, and they find the alien ship, and I could not tell you after that scene if any of those three men were in the base, or if they had just disappeared. I had no idea.
I think two of them were. There it goes. I think the guy who was running the radio, the transmitter, the glasses guy, the guy who was wearing glasses, I think he was there. Or maybe I'm thinking of the glasses guy in John Carpenter.
Is it this glasses guy, or is it another glasses guy? See, the glasses guy in John Carpenter's, his name was Fuchs. I know that.
But I will say, I did like that opening sequence, though. That was pretty cool. Like, just telling that joke, which is pretty light, and it starts off with this European sensibility where it's a slow burning intro, mm-hmm. and that has this really big impact. And I like just thinking of that situation that these men are in this truck. That's a scary situation to be in.
Oh, I agree. I don't even know how they got out of that situation.
Yeah, and I just think if I was in that situation, I don't know what we would do.
Yeah, you know? No. And they did a good job of jumping to a further scene chronologically where they didn't even have to explain how they got out of that situation.
Yeah. So, but I think one of the failings of this movie, although I don't think it's a perfect film, I don't think it's a great one or a bad one, but one thing that really doesn't go well with me is everything in the camp, in the research facility, being claustrophobic, being isolated is great. But once they leave that area into the third act, I think the movie just goes in this really weird direction. And, you know, gladly it's definitely towards the end of the film, but I was so taken out of that because it just seemed kind of preposterous.
We don't want to get into spoilers at all, but it really reminded me of another sci-fi movie that came out about 13 years ago, the third act of that movie. It just really felt like a copy and paste job from so many other movies, not just John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, and so like when they actually, and it just involves them leaving the research facility, and that's all I'll say. It doesn't really work that well, and they get caught, and they're trying to like, there's like this fight scene or this cat and mouse scene, and that really doesn't go very well with me either, because at that point I'm definitely taken out of the movie.
Well, at that point it just devolves into the creature chasing a few of the characters through this maze of whatever. It's just your typical standard cat and mouse of some creature in a darkened area, and you're hiding behind something, and it just busted through.
So, yeah, I think that, to me, where it just took it a little too sci-fi, I think that's all I'll say, it takes it a little too sci-fi, really doesn't help the film at that point. I guess let's get into, we've been tiptoeing around it, spoilers for...
we can get into spoilers. Okay, good.
Like, let's talk about the spoilers. Yeah. So, from this point on, if you haven't seen the thing, we're going to spoil it. So what we just talked about in that scene, just being so ambiguous, was when they leave the research facility, they actually go back to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that just didn't work for me at all.
It was the end of the first X-Files movie.
Ah, okay.
To where they find the ship. They go to the ship that's underneath, that's buried underneath ice, and they're just running through this ship being chased by a creature.
Yeah. But even being chased by that creature, I guess one of the final showdowns, really doesn't work because it's just kind of ridiculous.
Well, and it brings in some, like, weird moments for no reason. Like, what was that pixely thing?
Yeah.
That's just in the middle of the ship for no reason. It's almost like an alien TV that they never explain. They never do anything with it. It's just there.
I think what bothered me more so is when she's, like, caught, she's kind of trapped, and she drops one of the grenades that she has, and she's going for the grenade, and it's kind of this intense scene. The way they're cutting it is that she wants to get this grenade, and she's inching towards it, closer and closer. Then it ends up that she can't get it. She kind of gets caught, but then she has another grenade. And I'm like, why did you show that?
What was the point of that? Yeah. And I love how, we're spoiling the hell out of this movie now. I love how they've been flaming these creatures this whole time, but she throws a grenade in its mouth, and instead of it just getting blown into a million pieces that could turn into a million different things, it just bursts into flames. Yeah, that's how grenades work. Sure.
And so, like, that was a little definitely not very good at all. And actually, I kind of wish... I don't know how well this movie is going to do this weekend, but I can actually see a sequel coming from this, the way they end it, because it pretty much ends the same way John Carpenter's The Thing ends.
Well, it does, but it's not nearly as dark or nihilistic.
No, definitely not. But it ends kind of the same note where she's the sole survivor, and then it ends.
She's the sole survivor, but she's in a snowcat. And they've established through a shoehorn piece of dialogue that there's a Russian station 50 miles away.
And
so she's fine.
I can see that in a sequel, though, that they can actually have the thing at that Russian station now.
Oh, awesome. We'll have the same movie.
Well, that's inherently what this movie was, though. It was the same thing as John Carpenter.
It really was. It did nothing. Well, I don't want to say it did nothing new, because there was one element to this movie that I really did like.
Was it the face melting? The face marrying, I guess?
No, because I recognized that from John Carpenter's film, and I'm like, okay, that's how they got that.
Well, I actually liked that scene.
The effect was kind of cool. That was kind of neat.
I was geeking out because I remember the two-face thing in John Carpenter's, like, oh, this is how it happens.
Oh, hey, that one, half of that creature from John Carpenter's film is Eric Christian Olsen. No, and I do like Michael Broom's creature design. The design on the creatures, I thought he did a really good job. It was mostly the execution that I had a problem with. But no, what I thought this movie brought up, a new element to the thing that John Carpenter's film didn't, was this idea that the creature couldn't create inorganic material.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So part of the test this time around, instead of having the blood test, which was a great scene in John Carpenter's film, and this one they just check everybody for fillings.
I like that though. That wasn't so bad.
No, I really didn't have a problem with it conceptually, but the scene where they're checking the fillings, it's just a nothing scene. I didn't think there was any suspense in that scene at all.
I think there was a little bit, but not to the extent of the blood testing scene in John Carpenter's The Thing.
Especially since it's not a guarantee that if they don't have fillings, oh, they're an alien.
Yeah. And it actually has a bit of a payoff at the end with Joel Edgerton.
Yes, which I didn't really dislike that element with the earring, but I really wish they would have left it more ambiguous.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. That if it was more ambiguous, it would have been like, "Ooh, she killed someone," or maybe she didn't.
Yes, or maybe she didn't. In fact, I think I want to say that the screenwriter's his original intent for this ending was a little more ambiguous, where Joel Edgerton's character didn't scream like the thing when he got flamed. And she didn't, well, I don't know if she did blatantly mention the earring or not, but I would have liked it a lot more if, because when they were driving out to the ship, her and Joel Edgerton in the Snowcat, she just kind of looks at him. And you get this idea that, okay, she's checking him out, she's wondering if he's alien or not. And then there's kind of a close-up on the earring. And nothing is said between them, but you as the audience, you see, okay, he's got an earring, he's human. And then later on, they get back in the Snowcat after killing the thing in the ship, and the earring's not there. Now, if she doesn't say anything and just flames him, then the ambiguity still stands, but you're like, holy shit, why did she do that? I mean, it leaves it up to you, the audience, to pay attention to the scene and realize, okay, he doesn't have an earring, instead of her blatantly saying, "You know how I knew you were human earlier," which was just such a stupid line.
Well, would you have liked the movie more if it would have went that direction? I mean, at least it would have had that one interesting thing in it, I guess.
I would have liked the ending more. Yeah, I mean, that's an ending after a tedious and really unnecessary movie. But yeah, the ending would have been better.
Well, let's talk about the end ending. Like, yeah. I was actually a little disappointed when it said directed by and had his name there. I was like, oh, that's the end of the movie. I wanted to see the dog. I really wanted to see that dog and how it got, because that's all they were talking about is like, mm-hmm. we're going to see it's going to end with the dog running out. And they showed it in, which was kind of weird. I don't think I've ever seen a movie where they showed the tag during the credits cut in between actual credits.
You know what's weird? Actually, a movie that I just rewatched this afternoon was Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And they did it with that, too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think of that, how that happened?
As soon as I saw the tags start during the credits, I was like, okay, here's another. It was just another checklist moment. It was just another, all right, this is how they're going to put this flush up against John Carpenter's film to where you could watch it just like as one big continuous movie. It was nothing new. I think I wanted them to do something that kind of changed the way that I saw the original film, or something that was just a huge surprise, which they didn't do.
Yeah, but I think that's a kind of a double-edged sword, because if they did something like that, fans would be like, oh, you didn't do this enough. And if they did do it, it's like, oh, you didn't go, you should have not done that and did this, or you should have done that.
Yeah. That kind of goes to the heart of why even do a prequel?
Yeah.
You're not going to please everybody. You're not going to please most people, I don't think.
Yeah. But I don't know. This movie was either destined to fail or just taken in a direction like Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But even that movie doesn't follow the chronology and does things a little bit more. Well, actually, if you're a fan of Rise of the Planet of the Apes or the Planet of the Apes series, it totally takes what they've built in the Planet of the Apes movies and threw that out the window and gives it this prequel.
A lot of liberties taken in that movie, but I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah, but they did that to the benefit of the film, and it actually worked. Yeah. Where in The Thing, I don't think it works as well, but I still think it works on some elements. Another element I think it works on is it really does capture the 80s, or at least the look. Or at least that look John Carpenter has in his in The Thing, because it does look like John Carpenter's The Thing. Even the score was like Morricone, like was hints of Morricone's score.
Yeah, I did like Marco Beltrami's score. It like you said, it had hints of Morricone's original score. And yeah, that just I don't know, the clothing and the look of everything, the computer equipment, everything. Yeah, it felt very 80s, even though the film itself looked a little more stylish than you would get in the 80s.
Yeah. All right. So.
And I also think that nobody's brought this up yet, even online on Twitter or anything, but I did like how it opens with the old Universal logo. I always like when they do that.
I was actually waiting for that old Universal logo to, like, flip to the bottom. You know, the camera would switch to the bottom of the Earth, of the globe, you know, and show Antarctica. Because I actually like when they do that with a Universal logo.
Right. Like Waterworld?
Like Waterworld. That was exactly what I was thinking. That was the one thing about Waterworld that I liked, was that they had that logo and then it flooded. I was like, that's awesome. All right. So I guess you're not recommending this movie for people to see this weekend?
Not really, no. I think maybe if you've never seen John Carpenter's film, you might enjoy this.
So you want people to check out Footloose instead of the film?
Actually, yes. I liked Footloose, the remake.
I didn't see it yet, but from what I hear, a lot of people like it. We're actually more positive on that remake than this remake of The Thing.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I would recommend people go see it because it's October and you need to see a horror movie. This is not a bad one. It's not a good one, but I agree with Jeremy. If you haven't seen John Carpenter's The Thing, you'll probably really, really like this. But
I would say if you're really looking for a good horror movie in theaters in October, wait a week or 2 weeks and go see Paranormal Activity 3.
Well, that will be a tease for that next episode on Paranormal Activity 3, which actually I actually need to watch 1 and 2 because I haven't seen any Paranormal Activity movie. So I need to check 3 of those movies within the next couple weeks. Mm-hmm. All right. So where can we find you online, Jeremy Kirk?
Yeah, you can find my reviews every week at firstshowing.net. We also have the Golden Briefcase there every week. And you can also find me over at filmschoolrejects.com.
And I'm actually on your review of The Thing on firstshowing.net. Mm-hmm. And someone on here is calling you an elitist.
Well, yeah, I'm not surprised. That's actually kind of kind compared to what I've been called in the past. I think douchebag was last week's word.
for what review? For
God, I don't remember. Oh, you know what? That was actually never mind. That was my knocked up commentary article on Film School Rejects. Someone called me a douchebag because I didn't like it. The commentary, not the movie. I love Knocked Up, but the commentary on that movie is awful.
Well, at least no one started a fake Twitter account calling you the sleaziest blogger you'll ever meet.
Somebody do that?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Listeners, go to, follow me on Twitter, my personal Twitter account, twitter.com/Rudy_Obias. That's RUDIE_OBIAS. But if you go to twitter.com/RudyObias, no underscore, RUDIE OBIAS, you'll see someone made a Twitter account for me and said that I'm the sleaziest film blogger.
Oh, wow.
So.
Well, wait, they've changed it.
Oh, what is it?
Now it just says the film blogger you'll ever meet.
Oh, well,
that's all it says. They have no followers. They're following no one, and it's a private account. So it looks like they've given up, Brudy. You won.
I won. I won this battle. And actually, I friended this or wanted to follow this person, and they never got back to me. So, I guess I'm a little upset that I can't get back this non-underscore version of my name. But what are you gonna do? You can also find some of my work on Shakya.com. A lot of reviews on the New York Film Festival, which in the next episode we're going to have a whole New York Film Festival episode of Movie Night. And also AutorCast.com, where you can listen to my other podcast, The AutorCast. I want to thank Jeremy Kirk for joining me on this episode of Movie Night. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
So thank you for listening to our show. And so coming up next will be our reviews on the movies at New York Film Festival. We'll be right back. and welcome to Shakya Presents Movie Night. I'm your host. My name is Rudy Obias, and joining me is...
Barry Nemiroff.
And this week we're going to be discussing the New York Film Festival. The 49th New York Film Festival happened in New York City for the past 2 weeks, and we've been watching a bunch of these movies, and we're going to talk about three movies that were showcased at the New York Film Festival, and that will also be coming out later this year, like in end of October, November, and December. So these movies will be coming out within the upcoming months. First up, we're going to talk about Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. This movie got a lot of buzz early on in the year at Sundance. This was actually one of the movies a lot of people really enjoyed at Sundance. And I remember my Twitter stream kept filling up with a lot of people talking about how much they loved this movie. And so when I went into my expectations were somewhat high going into it because of all the praise that I heard coming out of Sundance. Perry, what are your thoughts on Marcy, May, Marlene?
One of my favorite parts about this one is that it is called a psychological thriller. And typically when I hear that kind of classification, I always picture, you know, like someone trying to figure out some sort of mystery, and then the thriller part being a shoot 'em up style gunfight. And here it is just so the definition of a psychological thriller, because everything is in her head, and we're experiencing it through what she's thinking and remembering and feeling. And that just makes it all the more powerful and emotional.
Yeah, this movie actually resonated with me very, very much so that, in fact, like maybe a couple hours after watching it, I was just trying to assemble the movie in my head. The way this movie is, that it, the way it unfolds, it's it shows you a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and that way it's kind of like a puzzle where you don't really know what's happening until like probably like the very end of the movie. But here's a synopsis from IMDb. Haunted by painful memories and increasing paranoia, a damaged woman struggles to assimilate with her family and after fleeing an abusive cult. And I think what I liked about this movie is that they never mentioned the word cult at all through it, but you automatically know what it is just by the way people are acting, the way that they're drugging everyone, the way... One of my favorite performances in it is the cult leader of it, Patrick, played by John Hawks, who has this very evil, manipulative hold on these very young people on his grounds. Perry, what did you think of the performance from John Hawks?
I thought he was fantastic. And like you were saying before, I love how they never classified his group of people. I mean, the film opens with basically a dialogue-less montage of what's going on in this place, and instantly you get it, and you get what's at stake here. So when she runs off, you know what kind of danger she's putting herself in by going to that extent. But his character in particular is really fantastic, because it's one of those characters where he's kind of loving at the same time as he's being evil, which... In my opinion, makes for a far more terrifying villain.
Oh, yeah. And everyone that looks to him as part of this camp looks up to him and has a real respect for him. And so I think that's kind of even more villainous in a way, that even while watching this movie as a member of the audience, you yourself are somehow seduced by this man, Patrick, and John Hawks' performance. It's very effective. So there's really two things going on in this movie. There of her memory of this woman's memories of being in a cult and leaving that cult and being reunited with her family, and how she deals with what happened in the past with her family. And so there's this big family drama about these two sisters just trying to be on the same page. What are your thoughts on how that end of this story unfolded?
At times, I was almost a little confused. Like, especially with how the story unfolds in the very beginning, where it starts in present time, and then and then it uses the flashbacks. Like, it took me a little while to jump on board with how the story was being told. And sometimes, just in general, I find flashbacks a little bit jarring. But the camera work on this is so incredible that the way it's shot makes those flashbacks almost, like, seamless. Like, it doesn't just, like, cut from present time to flashback. There's some sort of visual transition that isn't... That's clearly deliberate, but isn't so deliberate that you're noticing it. Isn't like a cheesy wipe or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it makes it feel very natural and the story feel like one.
Yeah, definitely. That there's this great... This movie is very fluid, even though it jumps from story to story. I don't want to say it jumps back at a breakneck speed. I think it's a very deliberate, slow burn of a movie. And so, listeners, going into this movie, just keep in mind that this is going to be a slower movie, the way it's paced. But I think it's very rewarding in the way it is paced, because you actually, like, live with this character of Martha, played by Elizabeth Olsen. And I was pretty blown away by her performance. And this is, like, the first movie that she has the leading role in. She's the younger sister of the Olsen twins, Mary Kate and Ashley, and so
she is incredible. Like, there's just something about her that is mesmerizing. She doesn't have to say anything or do anything. She just instantly grabs your attention and also manages to earn your sympathy too, or empathy. And that's kind of key in this, because the way the story progresses, she's not really presented as the most likable character in the world with what she does. And I mean, cause she almost, like, puts herself in that situation, but there's just something about her, and there's something way about the whole, about how the story itself is presented that like forces you to be on her side and want her to succeed and pull through this. But she's just a great find, and she's so natural and honest in the role, and she feels like a real person, which in turn makes the film feel real.
Yeah, definitely. I loved her performance, because I'm kind of with you. She's not really likable a lot of the time, but you're with her because this is her story and the way it unfolds. But you kind of live with the mistakes that she makes and the decisions that she makes throughout the whole thing. I would like to see her get nominated for an Academy Award for this, because I felt that her performance was that powerful to me, that this movie works because she works so well. I doubt we're going to see that this year, because this is the first movie that she's in, but I guess I could hope. Do you think that either her or John Hawkes would be in consideration for an Oscar for this movie?
Not because they're not good enough, but I see this movie getting overlooked.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, this, sadly, I do. To me, this is like this year's Winter's Bone. You know, this is kind of like the indie movie that could. Again, this movie came out at Sundance in this past January and had a lot of buzz, and it's... For me, it's actually pretty surprising that it's still kind of maintaining this buzz all the way into October. And I think it helps that this has been going from festival to festival before it gets a wide release. Personally, I would love to see this, not necessarily the movie get nominated for Best Picture, but I can, out of the two, maybe John Hawkes might get nominated for Best Supporting Actor, because he kind of... he didn't for Winter's Bone, and maybe this could be like a makeup for that. His performance was great, and her performance was great, and I recommend seeing this movie when it does come out in November. The next movie that we're going to talk about is the newest film from filmmaker Lars von Trier, Melancholia. Now, this is a strange film. This came out... Well, this premiered at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and a lot of critics liked it. It's a Lars von Trier film, so you're going to get a lot of controversy that goes along with it. Perry, what are your thoughts on Melancholia? This is an end-of-the-world type of movie where the world is ending, and it's really about how these people cope with that end in the last week of the Earth. What are your thoughts on Melancholia?
In the beginning, while I was watching it, I wasn't quite sure how I was feeling about it and if it was, like, I don't know, there was just like nothing exciting happening. And then just there's just this incredible, like, slow build from beginning to end. The film is cut up into two parts, and that build even jumps the line into the second section too. And by the time this thing is over, personally, I was just so incredibly emotionally overwhelmed, and I walked out feeling something that I can't really put into words, but this film just, it moved me, and it moved me enough to say this is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it moved me too. I felt that this is a very moving film. I loved the way this movie starts with this 15-minute, really just beautiful sequence of the Earth in space and this big blue planet called Melancholia about to collide with it. And it goes on for 15 minutes, and it's just so beautiful. And also what's going on Earth in kind of like the super, super slow motion of people panicking. I like the fact that you know that the world is going to end within 15 minutes of this movie, and so you're not watching it thinking, well, maybe they can avoid this. So that's not really in your thought process while you're watching this, that this is something that they have to get out of. You just see how these people either ignore the problem and go on with their lives, or kind of cope with it and accept the fact that the whole world's going to end. I like that it is separated into two parts, the first part being this wedding, this very beautiful wedding, and kind of like the kooky things that go on with this somewhat dysfunctional family. Perry, what are your thoughts on the first part of this film with the wedding, and I guess Kirsten Dunst's performance overall?
Well, even before the first part for that, I believe it was about 15 minutes long. It was almost like a montage of the end of the world, basically giving the end of the movie away.
Yeah.
I don't know if I think that was entirely necessary. It was beautiful. Like, some of those images are incredible. But I kind of forgot about it as the movie went on. It wasn't like it put in my head that the end of the world was inevitable. Like, I just never thought about it again. But the wedding scene is just fantastic. It is so incredibly natural and happy. And it begins in such a happy, joyous way. And you see this loving couple. And then just to see it all crumble, it hurts. And you so badly want Justine, Kirsten Dunst's character, to, you know, suck it up and make this work. And just to see the whole situation unravel. And it's a beautiful wedding, too, which makes it even more heartbreaking.
Yeah, that we learn as the story unfolds that Justine, again played by Kirsten Dunst, that she's kind of a little off balance mentally. And so I actually love Kirsten Dunst's performance in this movie. I actually think this is probably the best I've ever seen her in a movie, strangely enough. And I was actually pretty much on board with her from beginning to end. What are your thoughts on the second half of this film, when it kind of goes into Justine's sister's story with her sister Claire, played by Charlotte Gainsborough?
Charlotte Gainsborough is just so, like, her performance is just not flashy in the least, which is an incredible compliment to Kirsten Dunst's performance, who kind of warrants having the spotlight a little more in terms of her actions. But that second half is just the perfect intimate end of the world kind of experience, where you're living through this thing with just a core group of people. And it even more so than the fact that, you know, this planet Melancholia is looming in the background and threatens to destroy the Earth as we know it. It's almost like a family drama too. And just seeing how their dynamics change, and Kiefer Sutherland deserves a lot of credit too, because his character will just, I don't want to spoil anything, but his character does a few things that, like, bring you up, bring you down, and keep you guessing.
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised with Kiefer Sutherland's performance in this, because I haven't seen him in anything outside of something like 24. I think I just kind of resonate with him on 24. But here, he shows a lot of range, actually playing a I don't want to say a small part, but definitely a supporting role. A lot of our colleagues really don't like that second half of the film. They think the film kind of falls apart. in the second half. Where, in fact, that I think that I agree with you, Perry. I love that second half just as much as I love that first half. That second half needs to be there to A, have the whole movie come together, and B, really feel that impact of the first half through what, because what happened in the first half really does impact the second half, and it resonates even more so in the second half, in my opinion. I'm actually a huge fan of Lars von Trier, and I will say that this is probably his most conventional work, that this is not as strange or as weird as his past films like Antichrist or even Dancer in the Dark. But at the same time, this is still a Lars von Trier film, and he really doesn't like his character so much. He likes to punish his characters a lot. And he definitely does that here, but I think it really does serve this whole theme of the end of the world very well.
I am not a Lars von Trier fan, which really speaks to how great this movie is. Because I walked in expecting to, like, it was like a 10 a.m. screening, too. And I'm like, great, this is going to be a really dismal way to start my day. And I walked out just feeling so, like just special. It made me happy in the weirdest way.
I guess that's not a good way to start your morning. Yeah, when I watched this, it was in the morning, but I was excited to see it because I'm a huge Lars von Trier fan. But I guess I can understand, like, you know, you starting off your day with a dreary film from Lars von Trier. The next movie that we're going to talk about is the new film from Pedro Almodovar, The Skin I Live In, starring Antonio Banderas. And this is a strange one. Going into this movie, I really knew little about it. I knew it from the ads showing or the movie poster that it looked very creepy. I knew it was Pedro Almodovar, so I knew there was going to be a lot of melodrama. There's going to be a lot of exaggerated drama in this film. And I was pleasantly surprised to realize that this is actually a really great horror film. I don't think I've ever seen Pedro Almodovar tackle horror so well. Perry, what are your thoughts on The Skin I Live In?
I wish I didn't see the trailer before. I kind of knew what I was in for, and I wasn't like not even talking about spoilers, but I just thought the trailer, I thought the trailer was weird. I thought it was trying way too hard to be like artsy and confusing and desperately wanting to keep you guessing. And then what ended up happening for me is in the movie, I was too far ahead of the game to really appreciate the big twist. And it ruined the whole experience for me.
Oh, man. I guess it was beneficial for me that I didn't see the trailer or knew, I knew very little of this movie, because I went in not knowing anything. And the way this movie unfolds, I was surprised as it unfolded. And I guess from your point of view, I can see how you could, kind of see the twist coming, which I could firmly see after I watched the movie. But I was glad that I didn't know anything about it, so that that plot element really it hit me a lot more. So I thought Pedro Almodovar did a very good job of not giving you too much information, giving you as much information as possible, and then when that reveal comes, it completely makes sense.
I don't think it was necessarily his fault. I'm not blaming him at all. I just, There's one shot in the trailer that kind of got the wheels turning in my head, and that bled into my experience in the movie. But in terms of constructing the story, he did a fantastic job. I mean, what blows me away about this movie is how well he intertwined all the characters, his flashbacks and everything. Everything really serves a purpose and builds off every single part of this, really. It's just a shame that I didn't feel what I was hoping to feel in the end.
I could see that, but I absolutely love this movie. That for the longest time, like, I was thinking, how high is this movie going to be on my top five of the year? And I think it's pretty up there, maybe number two or maybe even number one, because this movie just caught me really off guard, and I think I appreciate it more so that, like, I hardly ever, like, screech or yell or go, ugh, during a movie. When stuff like that happens on the screen, I usually, like, laugh or cheer. This movie actually got me, like on that level where I was like actually physically afraid of what was going on the screen. Maybe because I'm a guy and like the things that happen in this movie like really don't serve men that well. And so this was a case when I saw this movie, I was just very haunted by it, that 2-3 days after I saw it, it was still with me. I was still thinking about this movie, and I really want to see it again. And I can't wait till this movie comes out. And I feel that this is one of Pedro Almodovar's best films. What did you think of Antonio Banderas' his performance in this as this plastic surgeon?
I thought he was great. I thought all the performances were absolutely great. Nobody did anything to... I mean, that probably actually helped in the fact that not being so surprised by the twist, like I was still able to enjoy this movie. And I think that comes from the performances, which were all incredibly natural. And I was really intrigued by his relationship with Vera, which in a way seems so honest and real and true, yet isn't. It just really kept me guessing the whole time. And I was wondering what was underneath that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Antonio Banderas in this film, and actually I think I pinpointed that I like his work, his acting more when it's a Spanish language film. Like when he's speaking Spanish, I love his acting. Like not so much when he's speaking English. Like and usually in his English speaking roles, it's usually like a comedy. But when he does tackle drama in English speaking roles, I don't think it works as well as it is in his Spanish, his native Spanish language. And so in that way, I loved Antonio Banderas in this movie, and he was just very, just kind of cold and calculating and very stoic. And that kind of adds to the horror element of this film, that he's doing all these gruesome things, kind of knowing what he's doing and just kind of cool and calculated while doing it, which is kind of even scarier.
Yeah, I love the environment. I loved his mansion. I forget what it's called, L something. I probably mispronounced, but I loved that environment and the secrecy behind it and the set design in there. That was all spectacular.
Yeah, and actually, I really enjoyed Ilana Ayana. I think that's how you pronounce her name, who played Vera. Mm-hmm. I thought she had a great role, to just going through all the emotions that this character has to go through throughout the whole thing. That are we supposed to be on board with her? Are we not supposed to be on board with her? What's going on in this movie? At least the way I'm watching this, just this level of confusion that went on while I was watching this, and I really loved her performance. What did you think of her performance in this movie?
She was fantastic. She was the one character that I really latched onto also emotionally. And she was kind of the one I was fighting for the whole time. And I need that kind of connection to bring me through a movie. And, you know, Antonio Banderas' character just was not the one to do it. And really, really none of the others either, actually.
Yeah. I mean, man, this movie just made me want to watch more Pedro Almodovar. I love his work. He is such a wonderful filmmaker. I really hope that he never makes that crossover to English speaking movies. That he'll make movies for Hollywood, because just having his movies in Spanish from Spain just really goes along with the poetry of what he's trying to do. And I really love the score of this movie, too. I often don't speak about the scores of movies, but the score of this movie just really... It was really driving, and it really hit me emotionally, and it was as much part of... It was one of the biggest parts of the movie for me while watching it, was just the score. All right, so I guess... the three movies that we talked about, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, Melancholia, and The Skin I Live In, on my end, these are all hits. Whenever these movies come out in your town, please see them. They're absolutely worth seeing.
I would say every single one of them. I mean, I did review them all, and I gave them all generally positive reviews, but if I had to rank them, I would say you must see Melancholia, you really should see Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and if, you know, this kind of story appeals to you, The Skin I Live In is fine, and it's a well-made movie.
And I guess don't watch the trailer.
Yes, please do not.
I'm going to watch the trailer after we're done here, but do not watch the trailer, I guess. Maybe that will spoil things for you. And I think the less you know about The Skin I Live In, and we're not going to really go into spoiler elements of that movie, but I think the less you know about The Skin I Live In, the better off you'll be. All right, so let's wrap up this episode of Movie Night. Where can we find you online, Perry Nemiroff?
You can find me at Shockey.com, CinemaGlenn.com, Movies.com, and ComingSoon.net. And, of course, on Twitter, my handle is P. Nemiroff. That's P-N-E-M-I-R-O-F-F.
And you can follow me on Twitter, Twitter.com/Rudy_Obias. That's RUDIE_OBIAS. Shakya.com, AutorCast.com, and everything that is Rudy at RudyObias.com. On the next episode of the AutorCast, I have two podcasts. Let me say that again. On the next episode of Movie Night, we're going to be discussing Paranormal Activity 3.
And, yeah.
Perry, I know you're very excited to see and talk about this one.
I am beyond thrilled about this one.
And personally, I think I have some catching up to do. I haven't seen the first two, so I have to do that before I watch this third one.
I'd be curious to hear what you think without having seen the first two, though.
I know the premise, but that's all I really know about it. Outside of that, I really know nothing. So I like the filmmakers who made this Paranormal Activity 3. The last movie they did, Catfish. I love Catfish. That came out last year, and I thought that was a great movie. So I look forward to Paranormal Activity 3. And actually, Marcy May Marlene comes out on October 21st, probably in a limited release. So if you live in New York or L.A., please check that out. Closing out this episode of Movie Night, thank you so much for listening to our show. Goodbye.